Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're jumping into a really fascinating and, let's be honest, quite challenging historical debate. We're tackling this through the lens of just one source document, an article actually, that gives a very specific, very strong viewpoint on some deep questions in Jewish thought.
That's right.
This particular article really hones in on the philosophical side of things, especially focusing on the monumental figure Maimonides, often called the Rambam.
Mm-hmm.
And it sets his ideas in sharp contrast with views it connects to certain people and traditions it calls Kabbalists, singling out figures like the Ra'avad.
Yeah, it draws a pretty clear line in the sand there.
So our mission for this deep dive, it's pretty straightforward. We're here to understand exactly what this specific text is arguing. What are the core disagreements it brings up? How does it define the players? And, you know, what does this article claim were the results of these big intellectual clashes?
And that's the crucial part. This source gets into, well, centuries of really complex and sensitive theological talk. It definitely has its own angle, and it's quite critical of certain traditions. We're going to explore this source's perspective, trying to be as faithful and neutral as we can. The idea is to help you see the material through this author's eyes, not really to agree or disagree with it.
Right. And because this source, well, it uses some very strong language and makes some pretty big claims about different religious groups and texts, stuff that could be sensitive. We want to be absolutely clear. We are sticking strictly to the content and the arguments presented right here in this article. We're presenting them impartially, just as they're written. No outside info, no taking sides on the views inside it. Mm-hmm. Our job is just to unpack what this source says.
Exactly. Just laying out the map as drawn by this author.
Okay, so let's unpack this. This article, wow, it doesn't waste any time setting a mood. It opens with this really striking call for repentance, for rejecting certain heretical books, even specific prayer books. Mm-hmm. It explicitly calls the Zohar filthy and demands the eradication of idolatry. So right from the beginning, you know, this source isn't pulling any punches.
It certainly sets up a high-stakes situation for the discussion, doesn't it? It tells you straight away the author thinks these disagreements aren't just academic squabbles, but, like, critically important for people's spiritual lives.
So the main players in this source's story are Rabbi Moses ben Maimon, the Rambam, and Rabbi Abraham ben David, who we know as the Ra'avad. He's famous for his critiques, his Hasak, on Rambam's big law code, the Mishneh Torah.
And this source really flags the Ra'avad as a key figure in what it's criticizing. It calls him the Kagos, basically, the first in the line of those. The source is defining as Kabbalists. The source also ropes in his father and his students, like Yitzchak Zagi Nahor, who taught others linked to Kabbalah, putting them in the same category.
And the article claims Rava didn't just disagree respectfully, but that he, quote, systematically insults and ridicules Rambam with what the source calls disgusting expressions.
Yeah, it paints a picture of some pretty intense animosity, both personal and philosophical.
Okay, so that sets the stage. Now, the source immediately dives into what it sees as the absolute core disagreement.
Right. The source points straight to Rambam's principle from Hilchot Teshuva, chapter 3, Halakha 7. That's like the bedrock here. According to the source's reading of Rambam, God is absolutely not physical, no body, no bodily shape, none of that.
Total incorporeal.
Exactly. And the source really emphasizes that Rambam sees anyone who thinks otherwise as a complete heretic, and even touts Halakha out worse than someone who worships idols. For this author, that's just non-negotiable. Foundational.
And this is where the source connects it to the Ra'avad and his teachers. This article claims that Ra'avad, while defending his own teachers, actually reveals that they were complete heretics in their thought concerning the Creator.
Mm-hmm. And how does the source say they got there?
The source blames their alleged heresy on reading certain Bible passages literally and also on what it calls confusing agadot, you know, those non-legal stories or traditions, as opposed to clear law.
Okay, so the source sees this as a huge dividing line. It then brings in this really powerful passage from Rambam's Guide for the Perplexed, Part 1, Chapter 36. And it interprets this passage as Rambam directly firing back at the views it assigns to Ra'avad's teachers. According to the source's interpretation, Rambam says believing God has a body or experiences things like, you know, sex, emotions, speech, sleep, It's just deeply offensive. Causes jealous anger, burning fire, hate, enmity, distress.
Strong words.
Very. And crucially, the source claims Rambam says this is much more severe than idol worship. And the source stresses that Rambam, in this passage, as the source reads it, offers zero excuses for holding such a belief. Not ignorance, not how you're raised, nothing. Just like there's no excuse for idol worship itself.
The article really hammers this point home. It references Rambam's introduction to Perek Jelek.
Yeah.
Where the source reads Rambam saying that doubting fundamental principles like God not having a body literally puts you outside the community, makes you a heretic, someone who needs to be opposed.
Wow.
And the source claims Rambam sees this as, well, a worse violation than just committing sins out of, say, desire or weakness.
Okay, so the source sets up this absolute position from Rambam. And its core criticism of Ravad on this specific issue is that, well, from the source's viewpoint, Ravad didn't fully get behind Rambam's uncompromising stance. Instead, the source claims Ravad defended his teachers, even calling them greater than Rambam, which the source argues makes no sense if those teachers held these supposedly heretical views about God having a body. It presents it as a major contradiction.
Right. Okay, so if the nature of God is presented as the first battleground, here's where the source shifts to another massive philosophical tangle. The whole free will versus God's foreknowledge issue. This is where it gets really interesting.
Absolutely. The source lays out Rambam's view on free will, drawing heavily from Hilchot Teshuvah, chapter 5. It presents this as a fundamental principle and a great principle and the pillar of Torah and mitzvah.
So the pillar itself.
Pretty much. According to this article, Rambam insists every single person has absolute, total free will to choose to be good or wicked. The source really underlines Rambam's view that God doesn't push or even nudge anyone one way or the other. Humans are unique in having this power for independent moral choice.
And the source points to the verses Rambam uses.
Yeah, it mentions things like, man has become as one of us, knowing good and evil from Genesis. From the mouth of the Most High comes not forth ill and good from Jeremiah. And those famous lines from Deuteronomy chapter 30. See, I have set before you today life and, crucially, choose life.
Choose life. Okay. And this naturally leads straight into that classic philosophical headache, the paradox, which the source says Rambam tackles head on.
Right. How can God know everything beforehand? Who's going to be righteous? Who's going to be wicked if people truly have free will? It feels like. Well, if God knew person X would be righteous, how could X possibly choose otherwise?
But then again, if it was possible for X to choose otherwise, even though God knew they'd be righteous.
Yeah.
Well, then it sounds like God's knowledge wasn't perfect or absolute.
Exactly. The paradox. And this is where the source highlights Rambam's, unique approach, as this author interprets it. Rambam admits this question is massive, longer than the earth in measure, broader than the sea.
Doesn't shy away from the difficulty?
Not at all. The key, according to this article's reading of Rambam, is that God's knowledge just isn't like our knowledge. For us, the knower and the thing known are separate entities, but God is his knowledge. It's not separate from his essence.
Okay.
So the source explains Rambam's logic. Just like we humans can't truly grasp God's essence, it quotes, man shall not see me and live, in the same way, we can't possibly grasp God's knowledge of thoughts, citing, my thoughts are not your thoughts.
So the conclusion is,
therefore, the source says, Rambam concludes, we simply cannot understand how God's perfect foreknowledge and real human free will coexist. It's just beyond our ability to comprehend. Full stop.
And the source makes a really critical distinction here. It emphasizes that Rambam, according to the source's interpretation, says this specific problem about foreknowledge isn't something you could potentially figure out through mystical insight.
Yeah.
Like the work of the chariot.
Right. Not part of that potentially accessible mystical realm.
No. According to the source, Rambam puts this question squarely in the category of understanding God's actual essence, which is impossible for any created being. Doesn't matter if you're Moses or an angel, it's off limits.
And this sets up the source's presentation of Ravad's criticism on this very point. Ravad, as the source portrays him, wasn't happy with this. He apparently criticized Rambam for starting such a tough question he couldn't really finish, basically leaving it as an unsolved problem and resorting to faith.
So Ravad thought that wasn't helpful.
According to this source, yeah. Ravad felt it might have been better to just leave ordinary people with their simple faith, or at least try to give some kind of partial answer, rather than highlighting a paradox you declare unsolvable.
And the source tells us about Ravad's attempt to give an answer.
It does. The article says Ravad suggested God's knowledge isn't a decree because God gave humans free will in the first place. He used this analogy. something about astrologers knowing future paths from the stars.
Okay.
But then adds that God knows both the influence of the stars and whether a person's intellect can overcome that influence. So that knowledge, Ravad argued, isn't actually fixing the outcome.
But did Ravad think it was a perfect answer?
No, and the source makes sure to point this out. Ravad himself apparently admitted his explanation wasn't fully satisfying. He said, and all this is not equivalent, or basically this doesn't really cut it.
And the source's reaction to Ravad's attempt?
Oh, the source comes down hard. It calls Ravad's try a huge error and says it borders on tremendous heresy.
Wow, heresy again. Why?
Because, from the source's perspective, Ravad totally missed Ramadan's fundamental point, that the issue is inherently beyond human understanding. By trying to offer a rational explanation, even a flawed one he admitted was flawed, the source argues Ravad showed he didn't grasp that the paradox stems from God's incomprehensible essence itself.
I see. So trying to solve it was the error.
According to the source, yes. And it adds another layer of criticism. If Ravad thought this touched on forbidden mystical stuff like Khwarizmi, why was he writing about it publicly anyway? That kind of discussion was supposed to be highly restricted.
Okay. This intense focus on what we can know, what we can't know, what the boundaries are, it leads us right into the source's definition and a very strong critique of the people it labels Thars or Kabbalists.
Exactly. The author of this source, claiming extensive study, comes up with a specific definition. For this author, a Kalat is someone who either tried to grasp Kal, those deep mystical ideas about God's presence or chariot, or someone who wrongly believed that understanding God's actual essence was part of Kalo.
So either way, a violation in the source's eyes.
Yes. According to the source, both attempts cross fundamental lines.
And the source then lays out a list of major criticisms against the people it puts under this Kabbalist label. What's the first big one?
First and foremost, the source slams any attempt to grasp God's essence at all. Especially, it says, when using human-like metaphors.
Anthropomorphism.
Precisely. The source points to what it sees as attributing bodily functions or relationships to the divine, using terms like pairings, divisions, or even describing divine aspects as monsters.
Monsters.
That's the word the source uses. It views this not just as a mistake, but as fundamentally impossible and heretical. It even claims it's worse than earlier pagan idol worship because it distorts the concept of God from within the Jewish tradition itself.
Okay, that's a heavy charge. What else does the source criticize?
It also criticizes them for discussing or writing about in public. The article insists that traditional rules say only the main points, the headings of such topics should be taught, and even then, only privately to one qualified, wise individual.
So secrecy was key.
Absolutely. The source argues that the very act of writing these things down extensively and publicly, which it accuses these Kabbalists of doing, actually proves their claims were false, because the logic goes, truly deep, hidden truths wouldn't be broadcast like that.
Interesting argument. And does the source link this to negative consequences?
Oh, definitely. It attributes really severe outcomes to these alleged violations. It claims these individuals broke boundaries, ignored the guidance of earlier sages, and that this directly resulted in terrible disaster and difficult and evil decrees. It specifically connects their actions to historical tragedies, like the expulsions of Jews from France and Spain.
Wow, blaming them for the expulsions.
Yeah.
That's a huge claim.
It's a very serious accusation laid out in this text. Mm. And the source doesn't stop there. It goes on to claim these same individuals corrupted Jewish prayer itself.
Why so?
It asserts they injected hallucinations and impure names into the liturgy and prayer books. It gives a specific example, mentioning the name De Carnusa, which the source claims was just invented about 500 years before it was written.
Yeah.
The source argues that putting such a name into a prayer is basically like worshiping other gods.
So corrupting prayer and even bordering on idolatry within the prayer book itself, according to the source.
That's the claim. And to back up its attack on anthropomorphism, the source brings in a quote attributed to Rabbi Yehi Kaffa.
Okay, what did he supposedly say?
According to the source, Rabbi Kaffa strongly condemned descriptions of God found in Kabbalah that involved sexual acts. The source presents him calling this vile, shameful, blasphemous, completely lacking any basis in authentic tradition.
That's quite a denunciation.
It is. The source quotes Rabbi Kaffa pointing out that the Torah doesn't even attribute the sense of touch to God, let alone sexual functions. He apparently questioned how such ideas could possibly fit with the unity of God or how Jews could be seen as a wise nation if they adopted these kinds of concepts.
Powerful critique. The article also uses the story of Mount Sinai, right? Exodus 19.
Yes, to reinforce this idea of boundaries. It cites Rabbi Abraham ben Rambam's interpretation of the command not to approach the mountain during the giving of the Torah.
What was his take, according to the source?
According to the source, he saw it as a spiritual warning. The boundary wasn't just physical. It was a warning against the soul trying to grasp things beyond its capacity. Dionash, Aldoz, or Long, the soul sort of bursting forth in thought into things too wondrous for it, only to get lost or destroyed.
And the source links this too.
It explicitly connects this warning, mentioning the example of Ben Azai, who, tradition says, was harmed by mystical speculation, directly to its claim that the Kabbalists, as the source defines them, ignored these vital boundaries around knowledge.
Okay. And finally, the source briefly touches on Chaim Vital. How does he fit into this narrative?
From the source's perspective, Vital basically continued down this same problematic path. He also wrestled with that foreknowledge versus free will problem, but within a framework the source fundamentally rejects.
So how did Vital approach it, according to this article?
Well, as the article describes it, Vital came across ideas in certain Kabbalistic texts, the Zohar, Sefer Hamada, Sefer Hakna, that seemed to suggest God maybe didn't know the future at the instant of creation, but did know it within a specific divine realm called Atzilut.
Okay, a sort of layered knowledge.
Something like that. And the source says Vital struggled with the implications, especially whether knowledge within Atzilut meant things were predetermined there.
And how did Vital try to resolve it based on the source's account?
The source presents Vital's thinking like this. Yes, maybe there's knowledge in Atzilut, but humans still have the ultimate power to choose differently, and you shall choose. The source says Vital used that Talmudic idea about the soul being sworn before birth, you know, be righteous and do not be wicked.
Right.
Vital's apparently reasoned, if God already knew with certainty what the person would do, that oath would be pointless, maybe even a lie, which seemed impossible.
So Vital's conclusion was,
therefore, in the source's interpretation of Vital, God must either not know individual future actions at the moment of creation, or maybe he limits this knowledge, perhaps confining it to this imagined world called Atzilut, specifically so that genuine free will can exist.
And the source's take on Vital's solution?
The source's critique is pretty consistent with its earlier points. It argues Vital, like the others it criticizes, took that Talmudic teaching about the oath too literally, misinterpreting a midrashic, maybe ethical point as a metaphysical statement.
So again, taking midrash literally is seen as a problem.
A big one, according to this source. It claims that tendency has damaged religion. Ultimately, the source concludes, Vital just went astray by trying to find human-level answers for things it insists are fundamentally beyond our grasp.
Okay, so let's try to zoom out now, looking at this single source's overall argument. What's the main takeaway here? This article seems to be painting a very specific picture, a highly critical historical narrative.
Definitely. It's arguing the core conflict wasn't just about, say, different ways to read a verse. It was about a fundamental clash in philosophical approach, specifically, where do you draw the line? What are the absolute limits of human knowledge and understanding when you're talking about God?
And it presents two opposing sides.
Exactly. From this source's point of view, Rambam is the hero who understood where the boundaries are. He accepted that some truths about God's essence, about how foreknowledge works, are simply unknowable for humans. Full stop.
And the others.
The source claims those it labels as Kabbalists, by trying to grasp the divine essence directly, by trying to solve paradoxes like foreknowledge and free will, they broke boundaries. They crossed lines they shouldn't have crossed.
And the result? According to the source.
The result in this source's view was theological error, corrupted religious practices, and even, as we heard, contributing to historical disasters. It presents Rambam as, quote, the only one who again aimed for the clear truth, precisely because he knew not to break those boundaries.
It's certainly a powerful argument laid out in this source. It paints a picture of these intellectual debates having incredibly high stakes and profound consequences.
It really does, and it leaves you thinking, doesn't it? From the perspective laid out in this article, what is the ultimate risk? Is it trying too hard to understand the divine, maybe pushing beyond the limits the source believes were set? Or is the risk greater in not trying, perhaps?
Versus the other path, the one this source seems to advocate for. A kind of intellectual humility, acknowledging that maybe some ultimate questions are just designed to be beyond our full comprehension.
It's definitely something to mull over based on the very distinct perspective we've just unpacked from this fascinating and, yeah, fiercely opinionated source text.